From the American Association of Nurse Practitioners, I'm the host of today's special edition episode, Nurse Practitioner and Education Specialist Patty Scalzo, and this is NP Pulse, the voice of the nurse practitioner. From the American Association of Nurse Practitioners, I'm the host of today's special edition episode, Nurse Practitioner and Education Specialist Patty Scalzo, and this is NP Pulse, the voice of the nurse practitioner. Welcome to NP Pulse, AANP's podcast, bringing you unique nurse practitioner voices and expertise on issues that matter to NPs and our patients. As always, be sure to subscribe to this podcast, share with your colleagues, and check back often for new conversations with nurse practitioners and healthcare leaders from across the nation. I'm excited to announce that NP Pulse podcast listeners may claim CE credit for this program through March 2025 by visiting aanp.org/CECenter, selecting this activity, entering the participation code provided at the end of this podcast, and then completing the post-test and evaluation. Prescribing medications for elderly patients can be a challenge. Pharmacotherapy in this population is complex due to age-related physiological changes, polypharmacy, and comorbidities. In the U.S., 35% of 60 to 79-year-olds are taking five or more prescription medications. One in six adults over the age of 65 will experience at least one medication side effect. Potentially inappropriate medications, which pose more risk than benefit to a patient, are an important cause of medication side effects. On today's podcast, we are joined by nurse practitioners Shantha Franks and Audrey Stevenson, who will be discussing best practices in geriatric prescribing and de-prescribing. Dr. Shantha Franks is a full-time faculty member at Ramapo College of New Jersey in the FNP and adult gerontology programs. She also maintains clinical practice at an internal medicine site and holds dual certification as an adult nurse practitioner and gerontological nurse practitioner. As an NP for 19 years, she has experience working in college health, long-term care, subacute care, and internal medicine. During her 12 years at a veterans long-term care facility, she collaborated closely with other members of the healthcare team to reduce unnecessary medications in the older population, including antibiotic use, and continues to promote reduction of polypharmacy in older adults, as well as antibiotic stewardship. Dr. Audrey Stevenson is a family nurse practitioner with over 40 years of clinical public health and leadership experience. She worked in public health for over 34 years and was the former division director of family health and clinical services of the Salt Lake County Health Department in Salt Lake City, Utah. Dr. Stevenson has worked in various inpatient and ambulatory settings and was a previous nurse consultant to the Salt Lake City School District. She currently works as a consultant, teaches graduate FNP and MPH students at two universities, and is a current faculty member of a graduate nurse practitioner program and a Master of Public Health program. It is my pleasure to welcome our experts.
Thank you for that kind introduction, Patty. My name is Dr. Audrey Stevenson, and I'm honored to be joined by my esteemed colleague, Dr. Shantha Franks. We appreciate your joining us to talk about this important patient topic. As nurse practitioners, we are seeing increasing numbers of older adults in our practices, and we know that prescribing and treating older adults can come with some challenges. In prescribing for older adults, we need to consider some of the physiological changes that influence the pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics. For example, our older adults have less body water and lean body mass. Hence, hydrophilic or water-soluble drugs have a lower volume of distribution. Some examples of drugs such as this are ethanol and lithium. Another specific change with aging is increased fat stores. Therefore, as a result, our lipophilic or fat-soluble drugs have increased volume of distribution. Some examples of this are diazepam, trazodone, and flurazepam. Lower albumin levels can also lead to increased drug toxicity due to decreased binding. With aging, there is a decrease in hepatic blood flow and liver size, and drug clearance of some drugs by the liver may be decreased up to 30% in our older adults. With aging, renal size and blood flow decreases, and glomerular filtration declines. Also, due to a decrease in lean muscle mass with aging, the production of creatinine is reduced. This reduced glomerular filtration rate counters decreased creatinine production, and our serum creatinine stays normal. Consequently, testing serum creatinine does not accurately reflect creatinine clearance in the elderly. The Krockhoff-Gault equation can estimate a patient's creatinine clearance when prescribing a new medication or changing doses. In prescribing for our older adults, there are four important points to discuss with your patients or family members as they age. First, older bodies respond to and process medications differently. This is based on the physiological changes associated with aging. A medication that was prescribed to a younger patient may work differently as they age. There is a weaker evidence base for medication effectiveness in people with multiple comorbidities and frailty. Larger medication burden leads to additive adverse effects. Treatment goals evolve as patients near the end of their life. Polypharmacy is defined as the concurrent prescription of five or more medications. It's not unusual in our practices to have patients routinely using five or more medications, including a mix of prescription, over-the-counter, or herbal supplements. To look more closely at the issue of polypharmacy, let's look at some statistics. In the U.S., 35% of patients between the ages of 60 and 79 years of age are taking five or more prescription medications. One in six adults over the age of 65 will experience at least one medication side effect. The five most commonly prescribed medication types for patients between the ages of 60 and 79 are lipid-lowering medications, anti-diabetic agents, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, and proton pump inhibitors. The inappropriate prescribing in the elderly can lead to such things as falls and fractures, functional or cognitive impairment. We can see adverse reactions. The potential for an adverse event goes up as the number of prescriptions increases. An elderly person with two medications has a 6% chance of an adverse event, but the elderly person on five medications has a 50% chance of an adverse event. In addition, we can see increased hospitalizations or even death. So what are some risk factors contributing to polypharmacy? Well, advanced age, prescribing cascades. These occur when initiating a medication to treat a symptom that's caused by another medications. Chronic medical conditions. Receiving care from multiple sources and providers. The use of different health systems that do not share patient health data with other systems. Or the undisclosed use of over-the-counter products. Shantha, I know that we have both encountered patients who are taking multiple medications. Can you walk us through a case study?
Absolutely, Audrey. And I couldn't agree more with everything that you touched upon. Polypharmacy is such a big problem in the older adult patient. So here we have an example of Harry. He's an 85-year-old male patient that presents to the office for his annual wellness visit. He takes multiple medications, and his two big complaints today are that he's lightheaded and dizzy, along with being fatigued. And he also states that he has been slowing down over the past year, but thankfully he denied having any falls. Now, his medical history includes hypertension, type 2 diabetes, coronary artery disease, BPH, arthritis, and anemia. And he does have more than one provider in the picture that includes a primary care provider, a cardiologist, as well as a urologist. And this scenario is typical of a lot of our older adult patients. His vital signs, blood pressure is a little bit on the low end, 102 over 68, pulse rate is 62, and normal respiratory rate. Now, here's his list of medications. He's on Losartan hydrochlorothiazide combination medication, 100/25 milligrams daily. He takes metformin 1,000 milligrams twice a day, glimepiride 4 milligrams twice a day, metoprolol succinate, the long-acting, 100 milligrams PO daily, aspirin 81 milligrams PO daily, atorvastatin 40 milligrams PO daily, tamsulosin 0.4 milligrams PO daily, acetaminophen 650 milligrams PO as needed, and he reported that he was taking it once or twice a day routinely, then ibuprofen PM or Advil PM daily at bedtime, along with an iron supplement twice a day. So you could see the medication burden in this one patient alone who's 85 years old.
This sounds a lot like the patients that many of us see in our practice on a regular basis.
Absolutely.
You know, the Healthy People 2030 has set the objective to reduce the proportion of older adults who use inappropriate medications. We're going to be coming back to Harry later in our presentation. So, Shantha, please share some strategies to improve the NP's prescribing practice in their population of elderly patients.
Absolutely. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is the American Geriatric Society BEERS criteria for potentially inappropriate medication use in older adults. So the BEERS criteria is indicated to improve medication selection in the elderly, to educate clinicians as well as the patients and family, as well as to evaluate the quality of care, the cost, and the patterns of drug use in older adults. So it was initially created in 1991 by Dr. Mark BEERS, and then the American Geriatric Society actually adopted it in 2011, and they've given a few updates, the latest one being in 2023. The initial intention for the BEERS criteria was to be used in nursing home populations, especially to identify medications where harms exceeded benefit. However, it has since expanded to include all older adults. So this is why I really like this criteria, because we can use it in multiple settings. And like we mentioned, there are a list of drugs that we want to avoid in older adults in most circumstances or under specific situations, such as if they have certain diseases or conditions. So there's typically five classes or categories in the BEERS criteria. It looks at classes of drugs as well as specific drugs to avoid or reduce in older adults. It also looks at drug-drug interactions. It gives us a list of drugs that have specifically anticholinergic effects. And then, as Audrey mentioned, because of renal impairment, it goes through medications and dose adjustments that we need to do with patients that may have renal impairment. So, Audrey, why don't you expand upon it a little bit more?
Expanding on the five general categories of the BEERS criteria, the first is the potentially inappropriate medications or PIMs. And these are defined as any medications with a greater potential risk than benefit in our older patients. The use of PIMs may lead to prolonged hospitalizations and many other problems for the older adult's health status. Medications that are potentially inappropriate in patients with certain diseases or syndromes, some examples would be prescribing tramadol in a patient with chronic seizures or epilepsy, or a history of falls or fractures and anticonvulsants. Use of diazepines, tricyclic antidepressants, and SSRIs, or using an anticholinergic in patients with dementia or cognitive impairment. Some medications to be used cautiously, there are 10 of those. First is ibuprofen, and this is related to the GI bleeding that we're aware of. So those that are using anticoagulants may be at a higher risk of those GI bleeds. Also, there's been data showing that long-term use is associated with heart and kidney problems. Acetaminophen, and who in our population doesn't use acetaminophen on a regular basis? But higher doses of this can lead to liver damage, and we need to use caution in those that are consuming alcohol or using those increased doses, and make them aware that there are many over-the-counter multi-symptom cold preparations and others that do have acetaminophen as one of the ingredients. We're hearing a lot about aspirin and some changes in the recommendations for the use of aspirin. So aspirin has been associated with increased bleeding risk as we age. Diphenhydramine, because it causes drowsiness, confusion, and decreased memory, and because it's an anticholinergic, it can cause urinary retention in patients with BPH. Pseudoephedrine or phenylephrine can increase blood pressure. Fluticasone and budesonide can increase eye pressure and exacerbate glaucoma in patients. Omeprazole, the long-term use associated with these medications, can decrease calcium absorption and increase the risk of C. difficile and pneumonias in some patients. Magnesium citrate can lead to electrolyte imbalances. Oxybutynin can have a side effect of dizziness, dry mouth, or constipation in our patients. And we need to also advise patients in the careful use of dietary supplements. There's also been some major updates in the BEERS criteria, and these include several different changes. But before I go to those, I know, Shanta, that you had some additional examples for those five categories in the BEERS criteria. Would you like to share some of that with us?
Absolutely, Audrey. And I appreciate that you mentioned a lot of the over-the-counter medications, because there seems to be a belief that if medications are over-the-counter, they are safer. And we know for a fact that that's not necessarily true. But let me expand upon a few of the BEERS-specific criteria. The alpha-1 blockers, for example, BEERS criteria states, avoid peripheral alpha-1 blockers. These include, for example, doxazosin, terazosin, prazosin, because if you use them simply as an antihypertensive, we now increase the risk of orthostatic hypotension in older adults. We can use them for BPH, but we really should avoid using them solely as an antihypertensive because there are other medications that would be safer for our patients. BEERS criteria also mentions digoxin and amiodarone, stating we should avoid both as first line for AFib and heart failure. In terms of digoxin, there's strong evidence for other agents to be used as first-line therapy to reduce hospitalizations as well as mortality, specifically in our patients that have heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. And when we do use digoxin, a higher dosage doesn't show increased benefit and can increase toxicity in the older adult. And this is because, as you mentioned, regarding the decreased renal clearance that happens, the same happens with digoxin and causes an increased risk of toxicity. BEERS criteria also mentions antipsychotics, both first and second generation, stating that we really should avoid them except if there are FDA-approved conditions such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, adjunctive treatment for major depressive disorder, or if it's used short-term as an anti-emetic during patients undergoing chemotherapy. And it has been documented that with both first and second generation antipsychotics, there is a higher risk of CVA, specifically in people that have dementia. And there is actually a black box warning regarding antipsychotic use for the management of behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia. So patients that have dementia that present with behavioral and psychological symptoms, we should try non-pharmacological interventions first. And we should also consider and treat any physical needs they may have. For example, thirst or hunger, pain, nausea, toileting, etc. And we know that there's multiple adverse reactions related to antipsychotic use in the older adult, including extrapyramidal symptoms, anticholinergic effects, which can lead to falls, cardiac arrhythmia, CVA, as I mentioned, and long-term use, it can actually even cause hyperglycemia, leading to diabetes, as well as metabolic syndrome. And then, of course, the benzodiazepines. BEERS clearly states that there is an increased risk of cognitive impairment, delirium, false fractures, and even motor vehicle crashes in older adults. And again, as you mentioned, the pharmacokinetic changes, this is due to the alterations in distribution and elimination. Long-acting benzos, those with longer half-lives, will promote more accumulation in the system as well as prolonged sedation. So we should try to avoid clonazepam, diazepam, if needed, shorter or intermediate acting such as alprazolam or lorazepam would be better indicated. So, Audrey, why don't you lead us through a couple more of the AGS 2023 updates?
So these are the latest updates that came out just this year. And as Shanta has mentioned earlier, we see these updates in the BEERS criteria about every 5 years. So the latest, the first that they list is about aspirin. And this is listed because the risk for major bleeding increases with age. And so the primary prevention of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease has long been one of the uses of aspirin. But the harm can be greater than the benefit in some older adults. So aspirin should not be used routinely in those older adults. Warfarin for the treatment of atrial fibrillation or venous thromboembolism It should be avoided if possible because warfarin has a higher risk for major bleeding, particularly intracranial bleeding in our patients. And this happens more often than the use of the direct oral anticoagulants. Therefore, the latter are preferred. Rivaroxaban should be avoided as it's a higher risk for major bleeding in older adults than the other DOACs. Apixaban is preferred over dabigatran. And if patient is well controlled on warfarin, you can consider continuing that treatment. The next one is antipsychotics. These include both the first and the second generation antipsychotics, and this includes things like haloperidol and others. The guidance says to avoid these agents except for FDA-approved indications, those things such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or adjuvant treatment of depression. The use of these antipsychotics can increase the risk for stroke in our patients, also heart attack and mortality. So essentially, the guidance is saying, don't use these medications lightly for the treatment of things like agitated dementia. So for those of us with our older patients in our practices, this can get tricky because agitated dementia is a difficult issue and there are no current great and effective medications. So the BEERS guidance recognizes this and saying that these medications should be avoided unless behavioral interventions have failed. So there are going to be times when we still need to use these medications, but we're going to use them judiciously. For patients with dementia, anticholinergics, antipsychotics, and benzodiazepines should be avoided if possible. Now, speaking of benzodiazepines, they should be avoided because older adults have increased sensitivity to their effects due to their slower metabolism. There's cognitive impairment, delirium, falls, fractures, as mentioned by Shanta, and even motor accidents. So some concerns affect the group of the non-benzodiazepines sleeping medications that are known as the Z drugs. Now, NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, you know, readily available over the counter and used frequently in our practices. However, they are on the list. And as we think through the risk-benefit ratio of using NSAIDs in our older adults, we often underappreciate the risk of these particular agents. Things like upper GI ulcers with bleeding occur in approximately 1% of the patients that are treated between 3 and 6 months with an NSAID, and in 2 to 4% of patients treated for over a year. NSAIDs also increase the risk for renal impairment and cardiovascular disease. Some other medications to avoid if possible include the sulfonylureas. So this is due to the high risk of hypoglycemia. So a short-acting sulfonylurea such as lipizide should be used if one is still needed. Proton pump inhibitors should not be used long-term if it can be avoided. And as Shanta mentioned, digoxin should not be the first-line treatment for atrial fibrillation or heart failure. Nitrofurantoin should be avoided when the patient's creatinine clearance is less than 30 or for long-term suppressive therapy. And then avoid combining medications that have high anticholinergic side effects, such as scopolamine, diphenhydramine, oxybutynin, and so on.
Thank you, Audrey, for really expanding upon the BEERS criteria. And we can see how many classes of medications are included. I do want to make a statement, though, that there are situations where we don't need to apply the BEERS criteria. And one example would be our patients who are on hospice. Because we know that hospice is more about comfort as people approach end of life. So our focus is comfort, not cure. As such, we are going to use medications, you know, specifically pain medications or anything that is necessary to promote comfort for the patient and provide the best quality of life. If our older adult patient has an allergic reaction, we would require providing diphenhydramine despite the anticholinergic effects. In our patients with hospice, you know, we would certainly consider discontinuing medications such as aspirin and statin. However, if they need furosemide for comfort, we would give that because if patients have congestive heart failure and they have fluid buildup in the lungs or the peripheries, this can cause discomfort. So what BEERS criteria is essentially saying is look at potentially inappropriate medications, looking at each individual patient and their situation, and consider risk versus benefit, and always consider individual circumstances.
I think those are important points. Nurse practitioners can best use the BEERS criteria for identifying, as you said, those potentially inappropriate medications and when appropriate to opt for some safer therapies. I personally have found the AGS Beers app to be very, very helpful, and it can be purchased for a very small annual fee. And you can easily search through the categories that we've covered previously in this presentation. And you can search by drug name or by disease and be able to bookmark and make notes for your patients. So, Shantha, what are some other resources you've used to guide your geriatric prescribing?
Absolutely. So along with the Beers criteria, I also like to use the STOP-START tool. And the STOP stands for Screening Tool of Older Persons Prescriptions. START stands for Screening Tool to Alert to Right Treatment. So why I like this tool is it gives us a little bit more guidance on when to stop a medication and when is it appropriate to start medication in our older adult patients. So for example, it would be appropriate to stop a thiazide diuretic in a patient with a history of gout because it can exacerbate that condition. It would be appropriate to stop calcium channel blockers in older adult patients who already have chronic constipation because that is an adverse effect. It would be appropriate to stop a beta blocker if your patient is concurrently on verapamil because this can increase the risk of symptomatic heart block. But it's also appropriate to start a beta blocker in patients who have chronic stable angina or post-acute coronary syndrome. We know the evidence behind the use of beta blockers in coronary artery disease. It would also be appropriate to start a statin in patients who have a documented or established history of coronary, cerebral, or peripheral vascular disease. So that's a great tool I like to use. You can find that online. Another resource would be the Medication Appropriate Index. There's also medstopper.com. Deprescribing.org is one of my favorites. They have algorithms, so they'll tell you when is it appropriate to stop a PPI. It'll walk you through, is your patient appropriate to be stopped? And then another resource that I like to use are our pharmacy colleagues, right? So a lot of facilities, hospitals use pharmacy consultants, and they typically provide reports on a routine basis. And I really like to look through that and see what medications I can discontinue. They're an extra set of eyes. So we can always collaborate, you know, with our colleagues. And we know that deprescribing is a team approach.
So speaking of deprescribing, can you walk us through the process of deprescribing?
Yes, absolutely. So let me give you a definition of deprescribing, which is found on deprescribing.org. Deprescribing is the planned and supervised process of dose reduction or stopping of medication that might be causing harm or no longer be of benefit. And deprescribing is part of good prescribing. We back off when doses are too high or we stop medications that are no longer needed. So, you know, judicious prescribing as well as deprescribing and a thorough medication reconciliation really needs to be completed at every visit. A fall or hospital admission in an older adult patient certainly should trigger a prompt medication review. And deprescribing has to be a shared decision-making process. So first and foremost, we have to approach this from a patient-centered approach. What are the patient's goals? Always engage our patients, family, significant others in the decision-making process. And then we consider, is the medication necessary? Are there non-pharmacological approaches that we could try first? Is this part of a prescribing cascade? As you had mentioned, Audrey, you know, we give our patients a medication, for example, iron, and then they develop constipation and end up on laxatives. So we have that cascade. Or if we give them a calcium channel blocker, such as amlodipine, and they develop peripheral edema, rather than providing a diuretic, perhaps we can get them off the amlodipine and provide something else to treat the hypertension. And then we consider what are the risk, benefits, and proven outcomes of the medication, and consider that Beers criteria for potentially inappropriate medication. So certainly there are communication gaps. There's patient or family fear of stopping medications, especially medications that have been used long-term. So there is a genuine concern with the recurrence of symptoms. There is concern that they may have changes in their functional status. And there's also some misunderstanding of risk versus benefits. Another issue that comes up with deprescribing is the issue of multiple clinicians. a lot of older adults, because of the multiple comorbid conditions they have, will have multiple providers on board. So how does a primary care provider go above a cardiologist to stop certain medications or above a pulmonologist? And this is where communication is key. As a primary care provider, we do need to communicate with our specialist colleagues to see, is it appropriate to stop aspirin at this time? Or if my patient is receiving dual antiplatelet therapy, can I stop one of them? And certainly engage our colleagues who are the specialists, because I think that also promotes trust and comfort for our patients, because they do have a genuine concern that if we stop medications, their symptoms will recur. But then the other thing I also do, Audrey, is I discuss the potential benefits behind deprescribing, reduce hospitalization from reducing polypharmacy, increase in functionality from reducing polypharmacy, cognitive improvement. As you mentioned with the benzodiazepines, they are a huge risk factor for cognitive impairment as well as dementia. And then I also discuss the quality of life with the patient and the family. So first and foremost, it is coming up with a plan that includes the patient and the family. And like we said, there are multiple challenges. Now, one of the things we have to consider, especially if our patients have been on psychotropic medications for a long time, we need to withdraw carefully. So I typically recommend one medication at a time. And if reducing the dose, especially psychotropics, I would say that about a 25% reduction at a time is a reasonable place to start. So certain medications that we certainly want to wean and taper versus an abrupt discontinuation would include medications such as opiates, clonidine, sedative hypnotics, gabapentin, beta blockers, and SSRIs. And we do need to engage the entire team, which includes staff, the patient, family, friends, to monitor for those signs and symptoms of withdrawal. So we need to plan a time for reevaluation, especially if we're doing tapering. We have to plan a taper schedule and then plan a time for reevaluation. And then we would continue doing this at each visit until we are comfortable with the medication profile, and not just we as the provider, but the patient especially. And then we have to regularly review the medications. And as we regularly review them, then we would identify potentially inappropriate medications, all those classes of medications and more that we had discussed at length in the Beers criteria. Do you have any thoughts on that, Audrey?
You know, I agree with everything that you've previously said. And for our patients, I would want to understand the reasons for each of the medications. As you mentioned, who's prescribed them, how long ago, because a lot of times we've had patients who have seen another provider for an urgent care situation or for a hospitalization and didn't realize that that particular medication was intended for short-term use. And so they've continued to refill the prescription and use it when it's not necessary. And then back to, you know, the whole evaluation of the medications that the patient's using, I like the brown bag approach when I first am addressing the medications with the patient. I want to see everything they're taking, all of the prescriptions, all of the over-the-counter, even the PRN meds, because a lot of times patients will not mention the medications that they're receiving from another provider. They'll only talk about the medications that I prescribed for them or that I'm aware of or part of my EMR. So I think it's really important that we have those conversations with the patients. I like your approach of one medication at a time, reevaluating, going slow, and identifying what the patient's goals are. You know, are they looking for quality of life as opposed to longevity? And then explaining any changes and our rationale for those changes, not just to the patient, as you've mentioned, but also including that whole family. Because in many cases with our older adults, there may be family members who are administering some of these medications.
Absolutely. And you touched upon a great point, Audrey, which is the brown bag method. And if any of our listeners are not familiar, that's basically just asking our patients to put every medication they're taking, both prescription and over the counter, into a brown bag or plastic bag and bring it to their visit so that their provider can sit down with them. And as you take out each med, we want to know why the patient is taking it. Are they taking it as prescribed? And are there ones that we can discontinue? And oftentimes, as you mentioned, Audrey, patients will only tell us the ones that we have prescribed and perhaps not over-the-counter medications. And as you clearly mentioned, there are a lot of over-the-counter medications that can cause harm to our patient. So if we can circle back around to the case study that we had started with, we can practice a little bit of de-prescribing. So let's look at our 85-year-old male patient that came in complaining of lightheadedness, dizziness, and fatigue. And he has a primary medical history of hypertension, type 2 diabetes, coronary artery disease, BPH, arthritis, as well as anemia. And his medication list, we started off with 11 medications. He's on a triple antihypertensive therapy, the losartan hydrochlorothiazide, as well as the metoprolol succinate at 100 milligrams. He's on dual antihyperglycemic therapy, metformin 1000 BID, as well as glimepiride 4 milligrams BID, and that sulfonylurea should raise a red flag right there. He's on aspirin 81 daily, atorvastatin 40 daily, tamsulosin 0.4 milligrams daily, PRN acetaminophen, ibuprofen PM daily at bedtime, and an iron supplement. So how do we approach a patient like this? First, let's identify the potentially inappropriate medication. Let's go right to the Beers criteria. So medications that have anticholinergic effects. This patient is taking ibuprofen PM, which is ibuprofen with diphenhydramine. That is a first-generation antihistamine that absolutely has anticholinergic effects. So that would be a good place we could tell our patient, perhaps discontinue. And why are they taking that? Do they have pain? Most of my patients that take the PM drugs at bedtime, they're utilizing it for sleep. So then we talk about sleep hygiene and sleep patterns and see if there are non-pharmacological approaches to help our patients achieve good sleep. Another potentially inappropriate medication is the sulfonylurea, and this patient is receiving dual therapy with metformin and sulfonylurea. His A1C was actually only 6.4. So what is the best approach? I would say to discontinue that sulfonylurea, continue the metformin. At his age, a goal of A1C below 7.5 is appropriate. We don't necessarily need to get them below 6.5. The lower we drop them, the higher the risk of hypoglycemia. And then what I would do is recheck that A1C in 3 months, as well as monitor renal function, because we know that metformin, we should back off if renal function starts to decline. Another potentially inappropriate medication on this patient's medication list are the three antihypertensive medications. We have been aggressively lowering his blood pressure. And if you recall, his BP was only 102 over 68. Could that absolutely contribute to fatigue and dizziness? Absolutely. So he's currently receiving losartan, hydrochlorothiazide, and metoprolol. So how would you decide which is the one to back off first? Well, what we have to do is also put the whole picture together, look at his underlying medical conditions, and consider guideline-directed management. So he has coronary artery disease, so I probably would not get rid of the beta blocker, the metoprolol. He is a diabetic, so the losartan, which is an angiotensin receptor blocker, would be good to protect the renal function. So probably out of the three, the best one to discontinue right now would be the hydrochlorothiazide. Have him follow up in 2 weeks. And if the blood pressure is still low, I do have room with both the losartan and the metoprolol. Both are at 100 milligrams. I could reduce one to 50 milligrams. And then as he returns, we can continue monitoring. And then one other potentially inappropriate medication on this list is that iron supplement. So do we know what his hemoglobin is? Do we know ferritin levels? It's very likely that he's taking iron because he was told at some point to take the iron, but no one ever told him to stop. And iron can be purchased over the counter. So once I see what his CBC is, his MCV, is this truly iron deficiency anemia? And if it isn't, I can discontinue that iron as well. So now I have been able to drop his current medication list from 11 meds down to 7 medications. I would continue the atorvastatin 40 daily as he has coronary artery disease. I would continue the tamsulosin 0.4 for the symptomatic BPH. I would continue the losartan for the diabetes, the renal protection, as well as hypertension. I would continue the metformin 1000 BID, monitoring his renal function as well as A1C. I would continue the metoprolol 50 milligrams daily because that is a beta blocker beneficial for his coronary artery disease, as is the aspirin 81 daily. And then the PRN acetaminophen, if he needs to take it once or twice a day. But when my patients take Tylenol on a routine basis, I always tell them what the upper limits should be and continue to monitor the liver function, as you had mentioned, Audrey. And I just want to state that after we made these medication changes in this patient, month later, his dizziness had fully resolved. He was fatigued, but less, and he had no falls. And our goal was to continue to follow the A1C with the goal of 7.5 or less. And in this patient, our BP goal was less than 140 over 90. So what do you think about that case example, Audrey?
I think that you're spot on as far as your recommendations. And I would come up with the same recommendations if I had a patient present with these same medications. And I think your rationale is also spot on. I do have another question for you. So with your patient that are presenting and they're also using some type of a cannabis product, whether it's CBD or whether it's, you know, medical marijuana or something, how are you managing that with the polypharmacy?
Sure. So, you know, any new medication, whether it's prescription or over the counter, polypharmacy becomes an issue. So I think the first thing we have to identify is, what is the indication, you know, for the cannabis? Are they just taking it because they were, you know, family members had good results with it and they were taking it? Or is this something that they need? Certainly when I worked in long-term care, patients did have medications, you know, for nausea, severe anxiety. When you look at medications like cannabis, medical marijuana, you look at what are the risks versus benefits in that particular patient. I do not recommend it routinely in my older adult patients if they've been taking it. And sometimes they don't even acknowledge or let us know that they're taking it because there is some embarrassment. So we do have to ask specifically, are you taking marijuana? And, you know, and sometimes they don't even see it as a medication. So that's a good point that you bring up. I think it's an individual situation, Audrey, with your patient.
And I think the only other caveat would be determining the alcohol use by the patient, because a lot of individuals may be self-medicating, not just with cannabis, but they may also be using other medications, whether prescribed or illicit, that they're not mentioning. So important for us to explore all of that with our patients.
Absolutely. So Audrey, do you have any other guidelines or decision support algorithms that you would like to mention?
Nothing that comes to mind at this point.
Okay. And I would suggest certainly for our listeners to go to deprescribing.org. It's a great place to start. And I like the fact that they have algorithms, they have handouts, they have whiteboard videos. There are a lot of good apps out there. And Audrey had mentioned the Beers Criteria app, which is wonderful. The Stop Start tool, the Medication Appropriateness Index. Our pharmacy colleagues, as I mentioned, please utilize them. You know, if you work in a facility, whether it be long-term care or hospital, pharmacy colleagues are available and they are there to review medications with us and they can certainly help us. I know how much our consultant pharmacist helped us when I worked in long-term care with other nurse practitioners. And every month we would get a routine update from them. And they were very detailed in letting us know, hey, I think you should back off on this. And we looked at their renal function and perhaps you can back down on this. So it truly is a team approach. Do you have any final thoughts, Audrey?
I agree with what you've just said. I think that we need to utilize this team approach because whether we're talking to a previous provider for the patient, the bottom line is we want the best for our patients. We want to provide the safest prescribing possible, and we want to reduce the chances of polypharmacy and the chances of having those untoward reactions when patients are on multiple medications.
Absolutely. And I just want to say, you know, remember that deprescribing is a part of good prescribing. We do need to understand that because, as Audrey mentioned clearly, it's well documented the harms that polypharmacy poses to older adult patients. As people age, we need to consider renal hepatic function and cut back on medication. Less is more, absolutely, in older adults. Always consider risk versus benefit while also considering guideline-directed therapy, because we don't want to not give our patients the best practice, you know, medications and treatments. And if you're a newer clinician and you don't have much experience yet with both prescribing and deprescribing, I would say engage fellow nurse practitioners or other healthcare providers who've been doing this for a while. And then utilize the resources that we suggested, such as BEER, StopStart, deprescribing.org, et cetera. Have the app on your phone. Use consultant pharmacists. And finally, Audrey and I just want to say thank you to AANP for providing us with this tremendous opportunity to discuss something that we are both clearly passionate about. We hope that it will be a good resource for our fellow clinicians as they continue in their journey to reduce unnecessary medications. Thank you.
Thank you, Shanta and Audrey, for this interesting and informative podcast. To our listeners, I hope you found this episode educational and can apply some of what was discussed to your practice. Join your National Professional Association and add your voice to over 120,000 of your NP colleagues nationwide. I urge you to become an AANP member today. Membership gives you access to so many benefits, including tools and resources for your practice and the AANP CE Center, which offers a comprehensive library of CE activities for NPs of all specialties and experience levels. Exclusive discounts and many free activities are yours as an AANP member to help you complete state licensure requirements and earn the credits needed for recertification. You may earn CE credit for this podcast by completing the post-test and evaluation by logging into the AANP CE Center at aanp.org/CE Center and entering the participation code GERI2024. Again, that is GERI2024. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, share with your colleagues, and check back frequently for new episodes. Thank you for listening.